Hey everybody, just a quick note about the audio in this episode. You'll notice a couple instances in which there are echo. I managed to get most of the stuff out in post, but we couldn't get all of it out, and you'll just notice it. It's not that big a deal, but I did want to warn you in case you heard it and thought there might have been a mess up in the audio. That's just Skype being silly. So otherwise, I really hope you enjoy this episode, and I do really, really hope you will go buy Robert's book, because City of Stairs is really, really good. So on that note, enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
Brochures of the Bulakov Tourism Bureau with Robert Jackson Bennett.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Rachel.
And our special guest is obviously Robert Bennett. Hello, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Still breathing.
Still reading, that's good.
Or breathing, whichever. Yeah.
Always be reading.
I'm always reading, of course. So, really quick, this is your, I believe it's your fifth novel now?
Yep, this is number five.
Number five, after American Elsewhere was, I think, last year's novel, correct?
That's correct.
So, really quick, just to kind of start off as a general thing, could you tell us a little bit about maybe where this idea came from? Because it's, I think it's fair to say, somewhat different from the other kind of work you've written. And obviously it's something that's right up my alley, which I think will become clear when you start describing it.
Sure. I think it has some things in common with the stuff that I've written before. I tend to write about places where a reality is soft and usually where things feel like they're a little bit broken. Which would apply here. I had the idea, I think it was in 2012, I was reading a spy novel called, I believe, Dark Star by Anton Furst. And it was really interesting because it was a World War II spy novel, but it was from the point of view of a spy in the Soviet Union, which was really interesting. You don't ever see a Soviet spy spying on the Nazis. Usually it's very Western, it's the English, it's the Americans or whatever. So to see it from the Soviet perspective in Poland and things like that was really fun. And so I had just read that and I was cleaning my house. I get most of my ideas when I'm cleaning or driving. And in the background was the Turner Classic movie channel. And they had on this weird old film from I think like the early 30s about an English a tourist who goes to a fictional country in Eastern Europe. And as it turns out, he looks exactly like the king. So it's this big switcheroo thing with a bunch of hijinks. But I was thinking as that was on, I was like, I bet it would be really hard to be a diplomat in this sort of region where there's all these countries. They're all very old. They're all very dour. They all have their own rules and they have their own traditions. And so I started thinking about a book set in that sort of place. And then I was like thinking, who's the diplomat? And the first thing that came to mind was a Southeast Asian woman, because I thought that she would clash extremely well with these, you know, dour old men shooting a bunch of stags kind of thing. And I thought to myself, all these people are very mad at her. Of course they are. You can't have them like her. That's no fun. And so I said to myself, why don't they like her? And the answer came pretty quickly. It's because her country killed all their gods. And things just went from there.
So this book has been described by a lot of folks as sort of reversing the colonial narrative, because it's fairly obvious that Sepuri, if I'm pronouncing that right, was originally basically under the foot of the continental people, the people who had the gods. And after this massive revolution, and as you noted, the death of the gods, those tables eventually are turned. And so there's also a lot of resentment because, of course, now these people who used to be basically the top of the pecking order are to some extent under the boot of this other, what is essentially now a developing imperial power. And did you, was that like a conscious effort to sort of explore sort of colonization in a sort of reverse fashion? Was that something you really, really intended to do here?
Yeah, I thought it'd be, because I think that what the book does is that it looks at power and how people use power. For example, Saipur doesn't really invade the continent. They don't really run the show. They kind of do, but they only want to make sure that the gods don't come back. They're not really like invested in the future of the continent beyond we'd like things to stay kind of crappy here. I think that what's interesting is that the continent had gods on their side, but Saipur has money and they have their navy, and they're like, and so their point is, why would I want to invade you when you owe me a whole lot of money? We have all the banks, we have all the credit, you owe me money. So there's no reason to start wars for us now because we have all the resources and we know what to do with them. So it's kind of it was something that I wanted to look at, which was this clash between this very old sort of society with a very new one, where, you know, previously it might not have mattered how many like resources you had, how much money you had. You had the gods on your side, so that means that you won by default. And then having to get used to this new system where actually credit is extremely important was a fun little thing where that I wanted to look at, is them trying to come into contact and try to understand and try to get through the new world order.
One of the things that actually you kind of brought up that is related, I think it's around like page 150 somewhere, where I think it's Shara who wonders, you know, why is it that we were the godless ones? Because she's Saipuri and they're called the people of Ash in comparison to the continental people who are referred to as basically the children of gods. And one of the interesting things that she raises is like, why is it that we got no gods and they did? What exactly made that original system work? And I really like this idea of using gods as a way of kind of demonstrating power, and then of course the rupturing and the ending of power, or at least the shifting of it by the removal of gods. But also this sort of deep-seated, not only just the fears you've noted, but also this sort of inferiority complex that they have to kind of overcome as a result of this, even after that's all over with. I mean, this is somewhat in the distant past, that the end of that era, but yet it's something that they're still kind of having to deal with. This, like, what makes us, when we're not the children of gods, we're these others.
Yeah. I think that speaks a lot to a privilege, which is that there are things that are pretty like arbitrary that happen in history, where someone has oil or someone knows how to use gunpowder or someone just happens to fall into the right circumstances where suddenly they are kind of running the show. And what I've found, and I think this is just human nature, is that the ones who have found themselves in these good circumstances say, we deserve this. This happened because of some intrinsic quality of our own. This wasn't luck. We had this coming because of who we are. And that, of course, implies that those who didn't get it, well, it's because there's something wrong with you, that you screwed up. If you were a good person, if you were a good people and you had done things right, you would have had these chances, but you didn't. And I think that speaks to human, I guess, just pure vanity, which is that we always want to be a protagonist of the story. And if we have a good turn, we don't want to say that it was just kind of random chance. We want to say it's because of who we are. That's more flattering.
True. Paul?
So, yeah, bouncing off that, I was curious to summon any of the background reading you had done in constructing this narrative, constructing the relationship between these two societies. Like, had you read, like, say, Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is one of the books I was thinking of when I was reading this book?
No. I didn't do a huge amount of pre-reading on this, and I guess that makes me sound like I didn't do any research. I tend to read a lot of foreign policy wonks online, and they always have these like fun little arguments where they fight where they fight amongst themselves about you know, what made it so that this country got put in this place. So that's something that I'm always doing, but there wasn't any one book that I went to try and figure out how to, I guess, write this. Unfortunately, I don't have a particularly good answer for that.
Fair enough. I bring in my own biases and my own reading of what you had done and imprinting other authors on it. I apparently do that all the time. One further question, jumping subjects slightly. One of the more interesting things about this book is the idea of city as place. And while this is a secondary world fantasy and your first secondary world fantasy, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yep, this is my first
You focused. I mean, while we get hints of the greater world from the various characters and what's going on, you really focus the action on Bulakov. And I wanted to ask you and have you discuss how you came about creating that city, especially seeing all the visuals that you now have on your website.
The way that I started with the city was, cities have a grammar. There is a grammar to how a city is built and how it is designed and how it should flow. A city, to a certain extent, is a conversation between the people who live in it and the city itself. I mean, a city, like a place in a city, has a bunch of rules and purposes and things that should happen to it, both in things that it does actively and that it does completely passively. And what I wanted to look at was a city that has its grammar confused, that feels like a lot of its places no longer have that function or aren't sure what their functions are. And it was this idea of these places that normally would act like a chain in a link in a chain in a regular city that wouldn't function in this one. And it was just this idea of and trying to make that into sort of a larger like analogy for what is happening in that country right now. And that, you know, there's not a lot of self-knowledge. There's not a whole lot of, like intrinsic, purpose to it. They're not certain what the next step is and things just basically don't make sense. And that's what it's like in the city itself.
And that's actually something I wanted to bounce off of because, one of the interesting facts about this city, I don't think this is much of a spoiler because I think it's really the old, like maybe 75 pages in and it's like a side note. But when the gods were actually destroyed, the reality of the city, because the gods helped in the creation of the city, when they died, they took with them basically the realities of the city that they had helped design, which meant that so much of the city sort of collapsed. Everything about it sort of collapsed, and so you end up with this weird hodgepodge of a city that's sort of formed in the emptiness of that old world, and obviously is part of why it is still maybe destitute, I guess would be the fair way to describe it. And I'm curious to sort of explore that idea of the way in which gods might help, the way in which we can think of gods as being more integral to a world and the creation of a world. Because we when we talk about the myths of gods, and you do talk a little bit about that in this book, the myths of the gods you've created for this book, the idea that, you know, that there are all these creation stories, but whatever, how it actually happens to creation after the gods go away, and in this case, when they actually literally die, because it's sort of something that just kind of gets forgotten, I think, or gets left behind in the conversations. And here you've actually sort of explored that. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about sort of that interaction between the gods and the city.
Yeah, I think that I said that in the book, the city shrank by about two-thirds when the gods died. There is, I'm trying to think of the name of it. There's a famous, it's a woodcut from the, I think, like 15th century of a man who has poked his head through a hole in the sky and can see all the workings that are behind the world. And there's all these gears and all these wheels and all these struts back there. And that's something that I've always found quite fascinating, this idea of someone who can see actually how the world works. And I guess part of why of what I wanted to do was just to see what would happen when that whole system fell apart and things stopped working. The way that I think it works in the book is it's like code, where say you have this huge program that has like all these lines of code, and then at random, two-thirds of the code is gone, of the lines of code are gone. And so you have to wonder, what's it going to do now? How can this function? And the answer, of course, is that it can't. It won't make any sense. That was just something that I found quite fascinating, because we all have these ideas and these concepts that form our idea of who we are as a culture. And to take away and to act as though those ideas were gone and like had never actually existed, because that's what's really hard with the gods, is that it's not just that they're gone. It's that there's no sign of them having ever really been here, almost. The idea of losing some central part of your culture was really interesting to me. And they have this gap inside of them, and they're trying to find some way to fill it. They feel that they were part of a story, but they can't recall what the story is. So unfortunately, a lot of the Continentals in the story have chosen to make up their own story, which usually is very self-serving and is very flattering as to who they are and why they want to do what they want to do. Everything that they want to do is justified because of the story that they wrote for themselves.
And this leads once more into a little bit of my wheelhouse, because one of the things that you sort of briefly kind of hinted at here is the fact of the matter is that the Continental people don't really have access to their own history, including in many respects their access to the gods. I mean, obviously it's very difficult. I think your book explores very explicitly how difficult it is to actually cut this out of the conversation. But one of the things that's immediately apparent in your book from the very start is how integral the control over one's history becomes in essentially the oppression of a people. And so you have this opening scene in which seems innocuous at first. It's just like it's a dispute in a court of law, essentially, over like somebody put up a sign and it offended people, and you're thinking like, what did he do? Like, he put a penis on it and that was what he did? It's no, he put what appeared to be a religious symbol, and in this new culture, the Superior culture, that's illegal. It's banned. It's considered like a great immense offense, and he's not supposed to have done this. And he, of course, cries out in the opening pages. He yells out. He's like, how dare you people basically try to take our history and control our history and not let us have access to it, and yet you allow these other people to go and, like, traipse around and all of this material you got locked away somewhere. It's really a fascinating exploration of power, I think, the focus you put on history rather than just simple brute force, but rather on the culture and the attempts in that arena to sort of control people. And I hope that you might want to actually talk a little bit about sort of your focus on that particular aspect in particular.
Yeah, I'd say that there's one thing that is also said in the book about how when the gods first made the empire, the first thing that they did was they got rid of all the other languages, because the way that you speak is the way that you think. And so by removing all these languages, they forced the world to conform to how the how the all the gods and their followers think. It's also really convenient as a writer because everyone speaks the same language. But it's this idea that I guess can be done in real life, which is to make an assault upon a people's sense of self. And what's fun in fantasy and with a book like that, like this, is that the sense of self is a real thing. It is a solid thing. It is a god. It is a name. It is an object that can be, that has been removed. I think that is a much more like effective way to control a people, is to either control or to dilute that sense of self. Because if you don't have that sense of self anymore, then why would you fight? I mean, like you don't have anything to fight for. You wouldn't even think to fight, because that thing that you would fight for is gone.
Paul?
Well, going back to the talking about religion and the gods, I find it very interesting that you made the Seipuri so militantly atheistic and very secular, and while the Continentals haven't always dominated their neighbors, I mean there's clear indications of how the history works, but from what I can read and understand, the Seipuri have always been atheistic even long before they had contact with the Continentals. I was wondering as your motivations for setting up a culture that way, and the challenges in making a believable culture that doesn't have any access to the divine at all.
Well, they were controlled for about 1,000 years, which tends to wipe out your idea of how things were before, especially if you are living very hard conditions and you're not living past like 20 or 30. There's not a lot of passed down knowledge. So I don't think that the Seipuris really know how they were before the gods came either. But that was something that was really fun to think about, because in almost all cultures in our world, there is some faith of some kind about how the world works, about gods, about the spirits, about a world beyond our own. And what was actually kind of fun in this one was having it be up front where, yes, there are gods, and you're not going to get any of them. And just be like, oh, and having to deal with that, where there is plain evidence that there are gods. They're not for you. You don't get any of all the side effects from having a god, which most cultures in our world, they all assume that they do. Even the ones that completely disagree with each other, they both say that they're right. Seipur can't make that claim because the gods were actually right in front of them tearing things up. So it was kind of a fun thing to have them, you know, make their own culture without what for us is usually a very, very important part of a culture.
Well, thank you. You just made me think of a Harlan Ellison story, actually, For I Am a Jealous People, where God is real and God abandons humanity, and humanity gets to for another race, and humanity gets pissed, and humanity is faced with God working against them. God exists, and God's no longer for man. I don't know if you ever read the story or not, but I just realized there are parallels you can make between that story and City of Stairs. The humans are the Seipuri. They may have had gods once, but now they clearly God is against them, and they have to fight against divinity and with the weapons they have in hand.
Like in Greek history, the gods are what helped them beat the Persians in I think a few battles, and that must have really sucked for the Persians, right? Like, you know, we're a country, we got our own hopes and dreams. Oh shit. And being like, that's – and I think of them with their hands in their pockets and they're kicking a rock on the way home, because they're like, man, that's not fair. So – because it proves to you in a way that the world is against you. It's the same kind of thing. Like think of like a kid's like a soccer team. how they pray before the game. And let's say that God actually likes this one team. And then they win. They beat all the other teams. And so those teams must be like, wow, I really wasn't expecting that. What a pity.
Rachel, you got a question?
So if we don't mind shifting gears a little bit, I did really want to kind of hear more from you about how or what drove you to decide to make your main character not only a woman, but not a classic strong female character. And then so many of the supporting characters, you've got two of the supporting characters who are basically middle-aged women, which in a lot of popular culture don't actually seem to exist. So I was very excited to read that. But I just want to hear more about how you kind of decided you wanted to do your character layout as far as, like, the gender makeup particularly.
It just kept, like on the page itself, it just really worked. For example, when she goes and meets a Turian, at first, that was meant to be a dude. It was like I was thinking to be like a 50-year-old man, a governor, kind of settled in, very strict, very brassy. And then I was going to use him as a reason to kind of like show off how good Shara is at working with people. And then I was like, this is not interesting. This is kind of boring. I'm not sure that I want to write this. And so I was like, let's keep that character, that age, but make it a woman. And then suddenly I was like, all right, this is working. I really like this. Like, and have her not be, you know, someone who does not know what they're doing. Have her actually be pretty good at her job and have her be like pretty cautious and smart and pointing out like this plan is bad because of this and having someone say, oh, good point. That suddenly started working. And suddenly to a certain extent, she slowly became Shara's sidekick because you do have Sigrud, but Sigrud A knows a lot of this stuff already and B doesn't really care. So you have to have someone that Shara can explain stuff to. And that quickly turned into a Turian when she's in the book, you know, she wants to know this stuff. It's happening in her city. She wants to know what's really happened. What this has to do with her, and having Shara explain that to her suddenly worked out extremely well. And, I'd like to say that I had a huge reason for it, but it really just kind of worked. I liked, their chemistry. I liked that they were very different people and had to work together. That all just really worked on the page, and I'm not completely sure why. I think part of it was that it might have been because I wasn't used to seeing these characters in fiction. So I didn't have a roadmap for it, so I could kind of do what I want and make it work as I felt like it should. And once I threw away the tropes and once I threw away that roadmap, suddenly it felt incredibly freeing. So maybe that's why.
Yeah, I particularly Turian was my favorite character actually, just because she is just kind of constantly done with everything.
Yeah.
She's wonderful. So I also did get that kind of vibe, like she was a bit the sort of the Watson to Shara's Holmes, but
yeah.
Much smarter and more savvy and very surprising, which I adored. So,
well,
awesome job.
She will be actually the main character in the sequel. So.
Do tell.
Yes, yeah. So it'll be a lot of fun for having to deal with all the after effects of what happens at the end of this book, because she gets banged up a whole lot more than anybody else does.
Can I just say, because the so for her character, I kept thinking, because I think there's a moment in the book where she says basically the line from Lethal Weapon, I'm too old for this shit, and I just kept thinking that was who she was. She was Murdoch.
She was Murdoch.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because I tend to work with I'd say people around the age of 50 or 55. And the thing that is really funny is that they actually say that a lot. A lot of them are like, say all the time, like, I'm too old for this. And I was like, you guys sound like movies. You guys, I think to myself, that line's really hackneyed. And yet people are actually saying it. So, yeah, I think that she wants to quit. She's like, I'm old. I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go off to an island and get drunk. I definitely don't want to have to deal in this cold, frigid, weird place with a bunch of angry people. I'm sick of it. I'm done. Find someone who's young and can do this because I don't want to do it anymore. And so that is actually a really big part of her character, to have her be, you know, I'm pretty good at my job, but that doesn't mean that I like it.
Rachel, did you want to add something?
There was actually one other kind of thing that, you know, you said that the fact that you had these female character as your main character and then kind of the supporting cast sort of grew very organically. But then kind of on the other hand, I noticed that obviously it seemed that the Cyperi were very much more kind of egalitarian society as far as between the genders went. But then on the other side, you've got, it seemed quite a bit more misogynistic. And was that another thing that just sort of grew organically? Because the playoff on it was very interesting.
Yes. That was something that I thought about, where, like, let's say that you as a people are enslaved for a long, long, long period, and then suddenly it's gone, where you're not enslaved anymore. Not like, you know, you're in the real world where you're like, right, technically you're not enslaved, but you still will be incredibly repressed, and we will, like, make sure that the game is rigged, like, against you in every sense of the word. That's where it's completely gone, and you're free to do what you want. And, like, I kind of stopped and thought, and this is something that I hope to explore a little bit in the second book, about how they got to where they are at the start of a City of Stairs, where they would say, you know, like, I don't ever want to see this ever happen again to anyone, where there is nothing inherent in a human being that makes them better than some other one. That for them would be a really big part of their culture. And once I started to think that, slowly it became more of a part of how I wrote all the characters. And you contrast that with the continent, where I don't want to say any spoilers, but to a certain extent, when the Continentals, the gods sort of could react to their worst feelings and their worst ideas. And that leads to a dense hierarchy, a very narrow hierarchy very quickly. And I think that was probably the case in the continent, at least with Kolkhan, like, especially, who was one of the most popular gods. And so that kind of played off each other quite nicely. I did want to look at how one thinks about oneself and how that plays off of those who think about themselves quite differently.
So I actually wanted to bounce off of something, because Rachel, you'd raise the egalitarian question and the differences between Cyperi and the Continentals, and there's a lot of that. You explored it at very different levels. In fact, you at one point do explore different sort of degrees of that difference within the Continentals themselves, which I found that was really interesting. But the thing I actually was hoping we could talk about just briefly, you also deal with sexuality. And very explicitly, we learn, for example, from Shara's past, having had a relationship with a Continental. I won't ruin anything because that's important to the book. But some of that, you take a moment to actually talk about the differences in the views of sexuality. You know, to some extent, dress as one representation of that. I think one character at one point sort of accuses Shara of using her feminine wiles.
Yeah.
In a serious sense, like, he means it, like, how dare you? And she's just, like, deep down, like, kind of almost giggling, because it's kind of, she's manipulating him. But you do explore sexuality in a very explicit way, and the differences between sexuality. So in Cyperi, it's a little bit more open. Marriages are contractual, which I thought was really fascinating, to have these sort of short-term contractual marriages, and so people would have multiple marriages in a life, whereas that's very different in the continent, among the continental peoples, who are a little bit more rigid in terms of what types of sexualities can be expressed. I don't know if you might want to talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, sex is about the most human thing that you can do, and it's also, I think, for a lot of people, quite frightening, because you have to be quite vulnerable to do it. And like, it's all tied up in so many feelings and so much self-loathing for a lot of people and so much concern. People think about sex so hard and all so worried about it, about like, am I good at it? Is this person good at it? Do I look sexy enough? Am I acting sexy enough? Do I feel sexy enough? It's this hugely concerning thing. And so, of course, what I think a lot of people do is they want to put a lock on it and control it and keep it in a box almost. And so that's what the continent has done, is it's decided that sex is this. Well, this is for one sect of the continent, at least. Sex is this, and the human experience really is this horribly ugly test that we're being judged on constantly. And here's what's key, is that you are always failing. You will never do it right. You are at heart a sinner, and no matter how hard you try, you will always be sinning. And the thing that you have to do is basically throw yourself at the feet of this one God and beg for him to forgive you and purify you. And that's really what I think it's about. Is not just sex, but it's about the human experience, which is terrifying. So of course, they want to have that controlled and corrected. And what I think is important is that they feel like they are always being judged, and that sounds like it's a bad place to be in. But to a perverse mindset, it's actually quite good, because if someone's always watching you and always judging you, that means they care about you a lot. They are thinking about you all the time. And so here's a God that theoretically made the moon and the stars and the earth itself. But what he's thinking about isn't making sure that the sun works. He's thinking about how much of your ankle is showing in that one dress, or how you are preparing this type of wheat. And if you've eaten a songbird, and have you thrown ripe fruit on white tiles, things like that. And it speaks to this sort of strangely vain way of thinking, where to be punished and to be watched is, to a certain degree, the best thing that could ever happen to you.
I think Paul had a follow-up to that. Paul?
I did, actually. You were talking about sex and sin and the gods. I was curious, in branching out, at what sort of mythological models or ideas did you take in creating your pantheon? You have some really interesting ideas, some of which would be very spoilery to mention, so I won't actually go there. But the actual pantheon of the defeated and destroyed gods itself is really interesting. I was curious where you came up with the archetypes.
What's the name of the guy who wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces?
Joseph Campbell.
There you go. I read a whole lot of him in high school. And basically, as a result of that, in my brain, there's just this giant grab bag of themes and archetypes and things like that. I didn't look to any one god in specific or any one pantheon. I like the idea of it feeling like the Greek pantheon, in which, like, the gods are there, they're showing up, they're walking around, which is not quite, but it's also mixed in with this idea of how the gods show up in a way in these people's lives that is not comprehensible, like a bush on fire. That's how God shows up, you know. Why? Like that, we're not sure. So having it be like that, having it be a stone underneath a tree or a large fat moon, is how these gods show up sometimes, or a trembling a column of air, things like that. That was a fun way to make it feel like the gods are present and yet not comprehensible. We don't understand them. Maybe the Continentals didn't even understand them. We don't know. We don't have a lot of text on this. But what that does is it makes them feel both present and abstract. And when they're abstract, you can add in all these tropes and archetypes and stories. And what's always fun about those sorts of stories is that so many of them are self-contradictory and yet feel like they make a weird sense. Where, say, for example, this god had to eat this fruit, and then because the fruit was inside him, he defeated himself and thus used the fruit to bring the sun. And you're like, none of that makes any sense, like zero. But it kind of weirdly does. I'm not sure. I mean, like, if you draw it on a tablet, suddenly you're like, I'm getting this. I'm getting what this means. It was a fun little game to play to try and think of ways that the god's actions could be both, like on the surface, not understandable at all, and in an abstract sense, kind of resonate.
One of the examples I think that was really interesting to sort of tie into this, you have at one point in the book where you describe that it was easy for people to tell where the god's influence ended and merged into another god by who saw which versions of reality. Because people in the city of Bulakov would see, based on which god was influencing them, and the regions in which they live, would see things differently, would see the world in a very different light, would have different mythical perspectives on creation or whatever. And I found that really fascinating, this idea of sort of a way of taking what I think is even more weirdly abstract when you think about you know, the gods of, say, like the Greek pantheon, of all these like gods like hanging out in the clouds somewhere and sort of throwing lightning bolts. But here you have them being active agents, and the result of that is this mishmash of almost like a weird distorted sea of different ways of seeing that no two people can necessarily see things in the exact same way. I thought that was really fascinating. One of the really interesting parts of the book, I thought. So that's mostly a comment. There was no question there.
Okay, yeah, I was about to say that probably feels a little like how things are here in the normal world, where it seems like nobody really sees eye to eye on anything and keeps claiming that the world in front of them is completely different.
Yeah, I agree. So did someone else have a question, or do you just want me to keep talking, people?
Well, I was kind of wondering, since you were kind of, you know, setting up a cultural clash between this, you know, the sort of culture that had the gods helping them out, so yay, we deserve everything, and then the kind of anti-theist culture, it also in many ways started feeling like a little bit of a clash between sort of rationalism and non-rationalism, if that makes sense. And, you know, was that just kind of, did it just play into what you had already set up?
Well, you know, it was just fun because for them, it's not non-rational. It's completely rational. I mean, there are rules. The world is following rules. It's just that these rules happen to be completely fly in the face of how the world works in all other places, where the sun shines through the walls in the morning. That just happens every morning, and we're used to it. And I'm sorry that that's not how things work in your city. That's far away over there. But we've gotten used to it. And what's the problem? So it was just kind of a fun way to look at how our perceptions of the world sometimes are so, I guess, projected on the world, and that in this book, in this world, it's literal.
Okay, so we got to switch tactics or topics, rather, not tactics. Yeah, we're gonna get violent now, Robert. We're gonna be mean with our questions. Because someone we've not talked about yet is Sigrid.
Ah, yeah, I was going to ask about him too.
Yeah, because I think it's fair to describe Sigrid as a badass. Also, maybe slightly insane. But maybe in a kind of a good way. So just a little bit of a rough history. So he's a Draeling, which means he comes from... I wanted to say it was much like kind of like a Viking enthusiast. inspired culture, although we don't have much of them except through Sigrid. I found him an utterly fascinating figure because he serves as Shara's quote-unquote secretary, which is, I think, just code word for muscle and informant finder. But he's an absolutely fascinating figure because he's sort of bizarre, but also incredibly powerful, both physically but also intellectually. I mean, he's not to be underestimated. And so I was hoping you could talk a little bit about sort of the creation of his character and what you were kind of reaching for with him in particular.
When I was just out of college, there was a group of folks that I used to hang out with a whole lot, and somehow or like another, they always had a lot of exchange students, who were always way older than you would expect. They're like 27, 26 that would come to town to go to school. And one of the guys that, we hung out with a lot was this guy from the Netherlands. He was like 6'7", this huge blonde dude. He wasn't buff. He was really skinny, but the way that he talked about things was always just very funny, where like how he said things, like, for example, one time, he was really big on, like, I want to do the Texas thing. I want to have fun in Texas. And he wanted to go and hunt doves, the shotgun. And he went out there, and then he came back, and we were like, so did you have any good shooting out there? And he was like, no, we didn't know very much shooting. There were no doves. We were like, oh, that's pity. He's like, yeah, I only shot a few turtles. We were like, what did you say? Did you say turtles? And he was like, yeah, I shot a few turtles. And yeah, like basically, he hadn't shot any birds, so he had a shotgun, and he saw two turtles like sitting on a log in a stream, and he just blew them away. and like hearing him like talking, he was like, yeah. And so here's a line that I will never forget. He said, the tricky thing about turtles is sometimes they are above the water and sometimes they are below the water. And I was like, really? We're breaking new ground here. And so hearing this voice in my head for Sigrid was always fun, where she was like, I found this thing out. It's a really big secret. I don't know if you can, if I can tell you. And he's like, I don't particularly care about that. And, this is not particularly important to me, is how I hear his voice in the whole, like in the whole story. And what's fun about him is that there's so many rules. This is such a dense world. There's so much history, and just having someone there to be like, I don't care. I don't care about this. You know, he's like, I'm so indifferent to this. This is not important to me. What's kind of fun about him is that he feels like, he's like, I'm above this weird thing that you're all into. I'm just here. This is your thing. I'm just hanging out. You know, I'm doing my thing, which is basically killing, stabbing people. I mean, like, he knows what he's good at. He knows what his history is. He has resigned himself to being this thing, whether or not that's true or not. And he's really kind of just indifferent to what's happening around him, except when he needs to be violent. He came from a lot of places. Brock Sampson, of course, I think is a pretty big, I think piece of who he is, although I feel like he's smarter and like a bit nicer than Brock is. He's actually pretty thoughtful. Something else was, back, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, when my wife would leave town, I would, watch a bunch of, Dutch films and Danish films. And one of them, is by a director, Winding Refn, I think is how his last name is pronounced. And he made Drive. He makes these super macho, very gritty movies. And one of them that he made was Valhalla Rising. And probably only about the first 10 or 15 minutes of that movie are good. After that, it's this weird, trippy thing that is, you know, very unusual, kind of hard to figure out what's going on. My wife would have been mad if I made her see it, kind of thing. But what's fun is that it's Mads Mikkelsen from Hannibal as a Viking in these filthiest, muddiest, this dour countryside. He doesn't speak. And it's him, and he's just basically killing the shit out of people. And it's not pretty. It's not cool kind of killing. It's, you know, like you have to hit a human skull a whole lot with a rock to fracture it. And Mads does this in the movie. It's very realistic about how many times you have to strike a human skull with a stone to actually break it open. And so I was watching that, and I was thinking to myself, I need to have this character. He's got to be kind of above things. I want him to be, like, you know, kind of ridiculous. And I was like, let's just make it Beowulf. Let's just make Beowulf and throw him in. I mean, why the hell not? And I thought to myself, I was like, that's stupid. And then I kept thinking about it. I was like, or is it so stupid it's actually smart? And I'm still not sure what the answer is. People seem to like it. So there you go.
Can I just say the greatest Mads Mikkelsen character was actually the character from King Arthur? He, like, gets a cool eagle thing, like a hawk that he hangs around with, and he's always, like, he's just great. And he fights, and he's badass.
Like, I think I blocked that movie out of my memory.
Just watch just the parts that he's in.
Well, yeah. But at the time, like, I didn't know who he was. But that movie is so ridiculous. Man, I'm kind of mad that you made me think about that movie. I think you owe me money.
We did it on Torture Cinema, so we had to think about it, too.
Yeah.
It's terrible. Except Mads Mikkelsen is amazing in that. He's just, like...
He's good at anything, man.
I know he is. He's just really good. But he's, like, the best thing about King Arthur. It should have just been his character. I can't remember which one of the knights of the round table he was.
I don't think it mattered. I'm trying to think. And, you know, like, what was kind of funny was, like, I had a friend who was like, really into history. And there's, like a Viking who's bald except for this, like, little ponytail. And he was like, you know, back in the day, that meant that you didn't have any testicles. I really didn't bring that level to this movie, so thank you for... I mean, I'm sure that the director didn't, so thank you for...
Oh my god, that's amazing.
That is amazing, I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh god.
Like, leader things, and basically what his hairstyle says is that he doesn't have a dick.
Wow, yeah, I'm pretty sure they didn't like that. Yeah.
Huh? This has opened a whole new angle on that movie.
And... Yeah, it's a whole new reading. There's going to be a whole lot of thesis papers written about King Arthur now.
Probably not.
Probably.
No, unfortunately, that movie is still terrible.
Yeah, God, man. I'm just thinking about, like, The Woad. Come on, man.
Yes, but Mads is in that, and he is badass.
That's true. Well, you should just watch Valhalla Rising. That's a much better Mads experience. Unless you have a weak stomach and you don't want to see a man get his guts pulled out using only a little piece of rock. He, like, cuts through the muscle. Anyway, it's an experience, kids.
I thought Flesh and Blood was gory back from the 80s. I guess it's nothing compared to this.
Yeah, I mean, like, he, like, takes an armful of this guy's, like, intestines and throws it on the ground. It's, don't fuck with Vikings. Oh, wait, I'm not supposed to swear, am I? Dang it. Anyway.
No. Have you listened to our podcast?
Yeah, but I didn't hear any swearing, so I'm trying to be, you know, like I got a 3-year-old. You think I'd be better at this.
You should hear me on every Torture Cinema episode. I pretty much use the F word. At least 5 times.
Oh, well, now I feel better.
Yeah, no worries. That we gave up on the being all, like, family friendly thing a long time ago.
Come on.
So, yeah. Well, okay. So, I think we're pretty close to an hour at this point. So, I think it'll probably be a good time to kind of wind down, unless anyone else has any last pressing questions.
Nope, I'm good.
I got one.
You got one. All right, Rachel, go. Last question goes to you then.
I was going to say, it's not a pressing question, but in the fantasy world where we make this into a movie, who's going to play Shara?
You know, I am a sucker because I don't know too many Indian actresses. But the thing that I keep thinking is that she needs to be really good at comedy because I think it's a lot easier to – that it's a lot harder to play funny than it is to play drama. It's a lot harder to, there's a lot more like timing and the pacing of the sentences. So even though, you know, she is funny sometimes, to a certain extent though, she is serious. I keep on thinking that it needs to be someone who is really good at making, at like how she holds herself and how she talks. So, but I don't know too much like Indian comedy sketch groups or anything like that. I'm not too caught up. Obviously, I've cast Sigrid. So yeah, that's me being prejudiced, having cast the one white guy. That would be something that I would be really interested in. It's like, it's kind of hard because, there's really only a hand. It feels like, at least from my perspective, I don't watch a huge amount of TV. That's not true. That's a lie. There's not a huge amount of Indian actresses that I'm aware of. And I don't want to be like, I would cast her because she's Indian. That's not a good reason to cast someone. I'd be like, well, she's the one character, you know, who I'm like aware of, who looks like how the character should look. That's not a good reason to cast someone. I had someone say that Sigrid should be played by The Rock, for example, because he was like big buff guy. The Rock. Yeah. There you go. And I was like, no. No. So,
no.
White guy.
If I was going to think of somebody to play Sigrid, the one guy I would think of is the guy from 13th Warrior, who's the main. Oh, God, what is his name? I forgot the name of the actor.
Antonio Banderas? No.
No. He's short and not Arab, which is confusing for that movie. But the main guy is like, he's basically playing a Viking, obviously. But that would be who I would have thought of. But that's because I like that movie, despite the fact that everyone else hates it.
Patrick Hester likes it. That's the one thing you two have in common.
Which is good.
So. I was going to say, just in case somebody springs a question like that on you again, look up Indira Varma.
Oh, yeah! She'd be perfect!
Yeah!
Can I do it right?
Yeah!
How do you spell Indira?
I-N-D-I-R-A.
I know who that is. She
yes.
was in Rome, right? She's extremely
yeah, she was in Rome.
Pretty, I mean, but maybe. I mean, like, but I mean, like, she was in the Kama Sutra back in the day. That was where like everybody first knew about Indira Varma because, you know, she was in that one movie that you got to see when you know, everybody was a kid. I could see that. She would probably be pretty good at that. But
She's done comedy.
Yeah, she's done comedy. She is like a straight up model, though. But
she could do Hollywood Ugly.
She could do Hollywood Ugly. She could wear glasses.
There you go.
There you go. Bam. You're hideous.
She could pull it off, you know. I think she's got a wiry and not a wiry face, but like a sharp face that if you don't like just make her try to like don't intentionally like cover her in makeup to make her look pretty, you just kind of like maybe like just have her be more natural. I think she could pull that off.
Well, like I will say that the like inspiration for her character was George Smiley. From the John Le Carré novels, who, you know, is not impressive to look at. He's a short, fat little man with thick glasses. And that was kind of how I thought about her at the start. You know, she's this short, quiet looking, skinny woman with her hair tied back in a bun. That was how I thought about her. You know, I kind of think it would be cool to hew close to that, to try and have someone who does not look that impressive and have her like kick ass. I think that would be fun to do, but I have not, you know, those sorts of people never show up in movies, so I have no reference point.
Well, how about we do this? If anyone listening has any suggestions, leave a comment on the website. And then we'll see what we can come up with, because I can't think of any examples, and I feel like I'm an idiot for not having any. Yeah. But there's got to be some really, like, that fit that description, but also can kind of do the earlier descriptions as well, the kind of the comedy aspect as well. So I think there's somebody out there for you, Robert, for your characters, I promise.
You know, like, it's kind of funny because usually I kind of don't like doing this because it's me saying, this is what that character should look like in your head. And, you know, that's not my job. I, you know, like, I write this stuff, but what you put in your own head is a lot better than what I'm writing. So it's your experience, and to have me be like, you know, it's Mads Mikkelsen, you know, that's not fun.
All right. Well, just to wind down then real quick. So I know you said you're working on the sequel, but that's probably not going to be out for a bit. But is there anything that folks should know, either maybe you have some like short fiction or any other work that they should expect in the next couple of months or maybe convention appearances?
Man, I definitely hope I don't have any work that's supposed to come out in a few months because I don't know about it. I will probably be at Confusion in January. West Chu said that he wanted to bunk with me. That feels like we're about to film a sitcom, you know, where like these two very different people got to share a hotel room at Confusion. I mean, that's its own crappy little movie.
You guys could make a sitcom. That would be pretty funny.
That'd be fun, right? Yeah.
Excellent. So Confusion in January is probably when your next con.
Yeah, and that's all I got. I'm kind of playing it by ear for the rest of it.
But that's far enough away, so that makes sense. So perfect. And then obviously the better question is, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
They can follow me on Twitter if they have a strong stomach at Robert J. Bennett. I got a website, robertjacksonbennett.com. I'm on Facebook, but I'm not exactly lighting it up over there. You know, the usual holes.
Fair enough. Excellent. Well, so thank you very much, Robert, for giving us your time and also for the really, really awesome book. I loved it.
Thank you. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite books this year so far. By so far, I mean it's freaking September. So to be in like basically the top two books of the year so far for me is pretty good. Yeah.
Happy to hear that. Thank you.
You're welcome. So thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Yep. And thank you, Rachel, for coming on for your very first interview, by the way.
Yay.
And thanks, Paul, for obviously being my co-host, as always.
Well, I love this book, too, Robert. As well as you read my review, so you know that already.
Yes.
Perfect. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.